Well, before I start, I just wanted to acknowledge the where we are right now in the Ben Linder room. How many people here know who Ben Linder was? Ben Linder was an Oregonian who went to Nicaragua during the Sandinista Revolution as a volunteer to install a hydroelectric facility in a small rural village that had never seen electricity. For this selfless act, our tax dollars paid a group of terrorists, which we call the Contras, to assassinate him in 1987. And that's who Ben Linder was. I'm going to talk about the connection between oil and 911. There's been a lot of discussion about the pipeline across Afghanistan. I'm sure most of us have read a number of articles that discuss the role of the Afghan war with a pipeline that was planned across Afghanistan. That's part of the equation, but it goes a lot deeper than that. It is true that former Soviet Central Asia, the different stands, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, don't understand, do have oil. But the early projections on how much oil was there suggested, well, maybe it might be another Saudi Arabia. They turned out to have been a little exaggerated. Chevron, for example, along the Caspian Sea, found that, well, there's a lot of oil there, but it's not another Saudi Arabia, not even close. There is a lot of natural gas there, but natural gas is very difficult to transport over long distances other than a pipeline. It's worth noting that even though the United States imports almost two-thirds of its oil from other countries, natural gas, we import 1% of our natural gas from outside. Transporting it by ship is extremely difficult and dangerous. Liquefied natural gas containing ships are like having a portable nuclear weapon in your harbor. It's extremely dangerous. An issue that's probably just as much of a concern for the Afghan war is the encirclement of Russia and China, part of the global empire that we are developing. Zbigniew Brzezinski, in 1997, he was Carter's national security advisor, wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard, where he advocated that the U.S. essentially run the world, and to run the world, we should run Eurasia, and to do that, we should run the former Soviet republics of Central Asia. And in there, he concluded that as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. This was 4 years before September 11. Now, people have been warning that oil was finite ever since we decided to start powering our civilization with it. But rather than encouraging a shift towards more renewable energies, what it's mostly done is spurred the oil companies to explore every corner of the globe to find more oil. In 1956, there was a geologist named M. King Hubbert, H-U-B-B-E-R-T, worked for Shell Oil, and he developed a mathematical model on how oil peaks and declines in particular oil fields. He predicted the United States would reach its peak of oil production in 1970, and the world would peak around the year 2000. Well, the U.S. did peak in 1970, and world oil production is around peak right now. There's a debate within the petroleum geologist community on exactly when the peak will be, but there isn't a debate among the geologists that there will be a peak and that there will be a curve of rise and fall. Even the most Pollyanna analysis suggests it would be 2030, but the Italian National Oil Company says 2005. So whatever the exact number will be, in geologic terms, it's a blink in the eye. Perhaps the best outcome for the oil would be if we have a global depression, which seems to be unfurling, then the amount of oil that we consume would be reduced, and the peak would be lower but flatter. And that to me, seems to be the best likelihood to use the oil to make the transition towards a solar-powered economy. If you look outside in the courtyard, there's a couple solar panels on the powering some of the lights in here. And to make those solar panels took oil to transport them, to manufacture them, to transport the workers who put them in, and so forth. But another point that's probably more relevant for the Iraq War than the peak is what's called the crossover point. And on the flyer I passed around, there's a chart that shows OPEC, non-OPEC crossover event. What that means is that places like North Alaska, the North Sea near Britain, Texas, and other places that have been drilling oil for many years are going to run out long before Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. And that once the crossover point is passed, Islam will control most of the oil in the world, not just in terms of reserves, but in terms of daily production. And it is said that the last two barrels of oil that will be extracted from the world will be Iraqi and Saudi. It's also worth noting that the geologists estimate that more than 90% of the world's oil has already been found. And the only country that is thought to have major reserves that have not been prospected is Iraq, because for the last 20 years they've had so much war and devastation and sanctions that they've not been able to fully explore how much oil is under their sand. Allah was more generous than Jesus. There's deeper implications still. A concept called embedded energy, which means you have to put energy in to get energy out. If you stick a pipe in the ground to get the oil out, you need to run the pumps to lift the oil thousands of feet out of the earth to a pipeline or tanker truck. You need to transport it. You need to run it through a refinery, then transport it to the local gas station. A couple decades ago, the ratio was 50 to 1. For every barrel of oil in, we would get 50 barrels out. Now it's 5 to 1. When it becomes 1 to 1, it won't matter what the cost of oil is because it will no longer be a source of energy. An analogy is if you have a fruit tree, well, the low-hanging fruit is very easy to get. You don't need a ladder. The fruit that's midway up the tree, well, you need a ladder and it takes more energy. And if you have a 20-foot tall tree but a 10-foot tall ladder, you're not going to be able to get the last apple on the top of the tree. The implications for our society are our population a century ago was a little over 1 billion people. Now we're at 6.5. This is possible because of fossil fuel. Food is produced with fertilizers that are made from fossil fuels. Pesticides are made from fossil fuels. Trucking systems run on fossil fuels. Tractors run on fossil fuels. Even organic agriculture uses a lot of petroleum in its production, although there looks most of the oil in Iraq and Saudi Arabia that the U.S. wants to dominate. And this is the U.S.'s response to the fact that their energy use is much more efficient and that the euro currency is the main challenge to the dollar worldwide now. So controlling their oil is our response to competition. In addition, with climate change just getting started, that also has the potential to disrupt food production. For example, in Ethiopia, the rains have stopped again, and perhaps 10 million people are on the verge of starvation right now. It's more severe than it was in 1984. There's a book written a couple years ago by Ross Gelbspan, former Boston Globe reporter. He has a chapter in here called The Coming Permanent State of Emergency, talking about the social implications of climate change. If water supplies are disrupted, if food production is disrupted, then this will not be a temporary emergency, but a permanent one. George W. Bush at his ranch in Texas has 25,000 gallons of rainwater storage capacity. This is somebody who understands what is coming, even if he doesn't want to help the rest of us deal with it as well. If you look at an aquifer map of Israel and Palestine, you will see that a large part of the conflict there is about water. Religion has an aspect to it, but water is probably more crucial. Which is why the military is seeking to use water as a weapon. There's a report called 2025, Weather as a Force Multiplier from the Air Force, in which they conclude that the importance of precipitation modification is likely to increase as usable water sources become more scarce in volatile parts of the world. And they're seeking to shift weather patterns as a weapon. How does this relate to 9-1-1 and the war of terrorism? Well, 9-1-1 in many ways was a psychological trigger point for the current acceleration into fascism that we are seeing unfurl. Many people heard an analogy that 9-1-1 was like Pearl Harbor. It was a surprise attack, but the same number of people killed. I read this book many years ago. It's called Infamy by John Toland, Pearl Harbor and Its Aftermath. Very respected military historian. It's about a 20-year-old book. And he makes it fairly clear that the U.S. knew that Pearl Harbor was coming in advance. They had broken the Japanese military code, and they had tracked the ships coming across the ocean. So, does the Pearl Harbor analogy match that? Last year, there was a book called Body of Secrets by James Bamford, a very respected historian, about the National Security Agency. And in this book, which was released in May 2001, he uncovered a Joint Chiefs of Staff plan called Operation Northwoods. Operation Northwoods was a plan just before the Cuban Missile Crisis to provide the pretext for an invasion of Cuba. And the idea was to stage phony terror attacks in the U.S. on U.S. citizens as a justification to invade Cuba. Perhaps the best analogy for 9-1-1 is what happened in Germany after Hitler became chancellor. The Reichstag fire. Are people familiar with the Reichstag fire? No? The Reichstag was the German parliament. Shortly after Hitler came to power, it suddenly burned to the ground. And a communist was found in the basement. And he was guilty and quickly executed. Shortly afterwards, this crime was used as an excuse to pass what was called the Enabling Act, which abolished democracy and instituted a dozen years of horrible dictatorship. After the crimes were over, Hitler's lieutenant, Hermann Göring, said, "The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism." I think the parallel for the current situation between the Patriot Act, between the Enabling Act, is the Patriot Act, which was also signed after a shocking act of terrorism. I hope everybody is aware that on November 25th, our city council will be debating a resolution to join the other cities around the country that have said we would like the Patriot Act repealed. Well, World War II was an oil war. Germany, as mentioned earlier, lacked its own oil supplies. And one of the reasons they invaded Russia was to get to the Caucasus region where there was lots of oil. But when they lost the Battle of Stalingrad, then those hopes were over. Japan also has no fossil fuel reserves and got most of their oil at the time from Southeast Asia. Well, I think it was Mark Twain who said that history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. So are there parallels between the Reichstag fire, Pearl Harbor, and what happened in New York and Washington? A lot of people use the epithet conspiracy theory, but that's not necessarily evidence for or against any particular circumstance. To me, the most damning piece of evidence is that the United States Air Force on September 11 did not intercept the planes going into New York and Washington, in complete and total violation of procedures dating back decades. Now, if you buy the official story that they didn't know what was coming and they got caught with their collective pants down, you could maybe see the first plane or two not being intercepted. But if you look at the timeline, they had an hour and a half to intercept the plane that went into the Pentagon. It was on the news in Washington, D.C. that a plane was coming in. There's an Air Force base 10 miles from the Pentagon called Andrews Air Force Base. It's where the president flies in and out of. The day after September 11, they changed their website so it no longer says that they have combat-ready airplanes there. For more detail on this, I would recommend a website called cooperativeresearch.org. They have done a tremendous service in putting together the timeline of what happened that day and the time leading up to that. Has anybody ever heard of the National Reconnaissance Office? One person? They run our space program. National Reconnaissance Office, NRO. They run the space program spy satellite systems. On September 11, according to the Associated Press, they were running an exercise simulating the impact of a plane going off course from Dulles Airport and crashing into their headquarters, which is just a few miles away. Amazing coincidence. And then all of a sudden they realized, oh, this is really happening for real. We should cancel the exercise. Maybe this was the way that the Air Force was confused enough, thinking it was an exercise, and so delayed the interception of the planes, allowing the attacks to happen. But if this was a tremendous screw-up, it'd be interesting to know why the general who was in charge of air defense that morning got promoted instead of fired. He is now in charge of the Northern Command, which is the domestic military command that was set up last fall for domestic military purposes. But there were plenty of prior warnings. In 1995, there was a terrorist interrogated in the Philippines who spilled the beans on a previous version of the 911 attack. Last spring, 2001, Richard Clark on the National Security Council is on record saying that all the signs came together that a major al-Qaeda attack was about to happen. When Bush was in Genoa, Italy, in July, 2 months before, the Italian military put up anti-aircraft missiles around the facility where the G8 summit was happening because they were afraid that someone was going to try to drive a plane into the summit. John Ashcroft shifted to a rented jet instead of flying commercial, which is what he had done. San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown was warned the night before not to fly to New York City. He won't say who warned him, but he didn't fly. Newsweek, 2 weeks after the attack, ran an article saying that a number of top Pentagon brass had suddenly canceled their travel plans for September 11. Salman Rushdie, the author, had a Federal Aviation Administration special ruling prohibiting him from flying on U.S. flights the week before the attack, and he's convinced that they had prior knowledge that this was coming. Germany, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Russia, France, Morocco, and other countries all gave some sort of warning to the United States that this was coming. In addition, the week before, there were a number of stock trades placed as bets that the value of United and American Airlines and a number of companies that were headquartered in the towers, that their stock value would plummet. And this is the type of material that's kept in real-time observation by the intelligence agencies who are closely tied to Wall Street. And that was another clue to see that this was coming. It should be noted that the other airlines that weren't involved that day, that no one was placing bets on their stock. So One commentator I read around that time said that bin Laden is merely a piece in a chess game. The stakes of the game are the last of the world's oil reserves and the Bush administration's consolidation of power to pursue a drastic, unlimited militarization of foreign policy on a massive and unprecedented scale required by long-standing elite planning, while crushing domestic dissent and criminalizing legitimate protest. We're about to have the Department of Homeland Security passed by Congress. Counterpunch magazine, which is a wonderful resource on the internet, has run a couple articles on what Homeland Security really means, tracing its origin to the Phoenix program in Vietnam, which was a death squad run by the CIA. It killed tens of thousands of Vietnamese people without any trial or due process of any kind. And it should be noted that the main debate going on in Congress right now is whether employees of this new Uber agency will have civil service protection, which is another way of saying that even the slightest amount of dissent will get you fired as an employee of this agency. It'll be a personal tool of the president to track down and harass anybody who shows the slightest dissent from what is going on. There are over 20 agencies being consolidated into this giant conglomeration. Some are small, such as the Critical Infrastructure Assurance Office, or CIAO, or CHAO, as in goodbye. Some are large, such as FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. During the Iran-Contra hearings in 1987, Congressman Jack Brooks, Democrat of Texas, asked Oliver North a question about his work with FEMA to suspend the Constitution in the event of a large-scale protest of a U.S. invasion of Central America. And he was told that can't be talked about in public. FEMA had even developed plans for detention facilities, and we are now seeing a taste of this with the couple thousand, nobody really knows, people who've been kept in indefinite detention since September 11, most of whom have absolutely nothing to do with any of this. And Homeland Security has been in the makings for several years. 4 years ago, there was a program called Military Operations on Urban Terrain, where cities like Oakland, California, Westchester, Pennsylvania, cities in Texas, Alabama, and many other places in between have had practice invasions by the U.S. military. I think our new military base across from Lane Community College is related to this, because if you look on a topographic map, if you wanted to control access in and out of the Willamette Valley as a military choke point, that would be the place to build the base. Fortunately, there are a number of even conservatives who are upset about this. William Safire, who is not exactly a liberal, wrote a blistering article last week in the New York Times saying that what is being proposed with Homeland Security and the Information Awareness Office is a complete violation of anything even resembling civil liberties. Even John Dean of Watergate has been writing articles denouncing the Patriot Act and what Bush is up to. I personally think it's very important to not worry too much about political ideology, and everybody who is against war and fascism to unite as broad as possible. I'm reminded of a woman in Israel whose daughter was killed by a suicide Palestinian bomber, and she was asked if she took condolences from the other side, and she said no, of course not. But for her, the other side wasn't the Palestinians. It was the people who were for war. And they are on both sides of the border, and they're people for peace on both sides of the border. A couple final points. The Democrats, unfortunately, seem very scared to challenge what is going on. Many years ago, I read a book called CIA Diary by a CIA agent named Philip Agee, who wrote, he was in Mexico in 1966, and he wrote how A cable had been sent from the embassy, where he was a CIA agent undercover, noting that the Minister of Internal Security had told the CIA that he had been secretly selected as the next Mexican president. The chief of station has no doubt that he was being intentionally let in on the secret, even though the elections won't be held until 1970. The information in the cable is extremely sensitive, not so much because it's a secret, but because presidential succession in Mexico is supposedly a decision made by a broad representation within the PRI. For years, leaders of the PRI have been denying that presidential succession is determined secretly. They even have a nominating convention and all the appearances of mass participation. Well, I think after the 2000 election, one could make a plausible argument that that applies here as well, since it's clear that Al Gore won in Florida and won the United States election, yet the Democrats let Gore not get the job. And while it's true that the Supreme Court shut down the ballot counting, it's also true that what actually technically made Bush president was the United States Congress voting unanimously on January 6, 2001, to ratify the Electoral College. Not a single senator voted against it and voted to support the Congressional Black Caucus, which was saying, hey, Florida was fake. We'd like an investigation of this. And the Democrats said, no, we don't want to touch this. And Al Gore was presiding over the Senate when this happened. It's another interesting coincidence that the anthrax attacks on Congress after September 11 went to the Democrats. It seems that Iraq was being set up to take the fall for this, to be blamed and use this as an excuse to invade Iraq. Fortunately, some persons unknown leaked to the media that the anthrax came from the military of the United States, if you traced the DNA. It did not come from the Middle East. I mean, even though we sold anthrax to Iraq during the Reagan administration, Iraq had nothing to do with this. How many people think that the death of Paul Wellstone was an accident? Anybody? A few? Well, even if it was an accident, it's an interesting coincidence that senators, 2 weeks before their controversial election, went down in airplane crashes. Carnahan, who was running against Ashcroft in 2000, and now Paul Wellstone in 2002. Except this time his wife was on board, so we didn't have Mrs. Wellstone run in his place. But even if it turns out that it really was a coincidence, although given that the National Transportation Safety Board is run by an admitted Central Intelligence agent, it still is intimidation. I mean, after the John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, people who speak out in national politics have to really be concerned about their physical safety. I mean, Martin Luther King was contemplating running for president on an anti-war platform when he was assassinated. And it's worth noting that his family long ago concluded that James Earl Ray had nothing to do with his assassination. At the time of King's death, he had become an anti-war advocate. And I can't recommend highly enough reading his speeches on the war in Vietnam. They send chills down your spine, because he predicted exactly the circumstances that we would be in now, talking about how a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. America, the richest and most powerful nation in the world, can well lead the way in this revolution of values. There is nothing, except for a tragic death wish, to prevent us from reordering our priorities, so the pursuit of peace will take precedent over the pursuit of war. Where we go from here is, at the minimum, we need an impeachment of Bush for war crimes, for gross malfeasance, if not much worse, for 9-1-1, and for subverting the Constitution that he has sworn to uphold. I was listening to the radio last winter and heard Bush on one of those little NPR snippets at the top of the hour say, if this was a dictatorship, it would be a heck of a lot easier, just so long as I'm the dictator. And there was no outrage in the press on this. And Bush actually said this. And I would quote the Constitution, where it says the president, vice president, and all other civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for or and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. We had Clinton impeached for something fairly minor, but for a radical transformation of our entire country into something out of George Orwell instead of George Washington deserves impeachment at the very least. Dwight Eisenhower warned us about this on his way out of office, saying, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process. January 17, 1961. I'd just like to conclude saying that what's kept us alive for 3 million years as humans and our ancestors is our ability to cooperate and share. And our civilization has developed tremendous talents and creative abilities. We stand at a crossroads, at a threshold. Will we use the second half of the oil to make a lot of solar panels to help ensure a decent standard of living for everyone around the world? Or will we use it to set up a police state world empire to scramble for the last of the oil? It'd be a shame to keep spending $1 trillion a year on this war machine, which is destroying the planet, it's destroying countries all over the world, and it's destroying our psychology. Now, there's the Ben and Jerry's quote, 1% for peace. Well, what it's going to take is 100% for peace. Thank you.